Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Reyes, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Judge Sarah I. Wheelock presiding. Go ahead, Judge.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As the Marshal stated, it's Thursday, June 30th, 2022. We have six cases on the calendar today, three of which are scheduled for oral argument via Zoom. Also, as stated, my name is Sarah Wheelock. I am the presiding judge today on a panel with judges Lucinda Jessen and Peter Reyes. This morning, we are holding our hearings via Zoom.gov, and so I can address a few matters in our virtual format before we begin. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings of these arguments are generally available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals website. I will also note that our appellate rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or a video recording of oral argument unless you have obtained the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with specific conditions established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And with that, Marshall, will you please call the first case before us today?
The first case is A21-1383, State of Minnesota versus Terry Lee Hauer, appellant.
Counsel, as you probably know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel, for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock up in the upper left-hand corner of your screen that will be counting down the time. And I ask each counsel to please introduce yourself and the party that you represent at the beginning of your argument so that our recording is clear. Please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you are not speaking. And finally, if anyone has difficulty with technology at any point, please let me know and we will stop and we'll try and address that situation because we want to make sure we can hear from all of you. With that, counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Eva Wales and I represent the appellant, Terry Hauer, in this matter. Mr. Hauer was convicted by a jury of DWI refusal and raises two issues on appeal: the sufficiency of the evidence to convict and whether the judge improperly limited defense questioning during voir dire. Regarding the first issue, the state failed to prove that Hauer refused to provide a urine sample. Mr. Hauer has a disability. He is physically unable to speak and can only communicate through writing, making gestures, or head movements. And this was known to the police officers. So when an officer presented him with a warrant for a blood or urine sample, as he sat in a wheelchair in an emergency room lobby, and after about 3 minutes, he gestured for paper and pen, then communicated in writing, he was a person with a disability who had established a good communication channel. After some questions and answers with the officer, he wrote the word P-E-E, on a paper. The officer clearly understood this to mean that Hauer would provide a urine sample. And the officer went to his squad car in the parking lot to get a urine testing kit. Hauer had agreed to take a urine test. But the officer returned to the emergency room and demanded another affirmative to test from Mr. Hauer to provide a urine sample. And this is the problem, because the additional affirmative was not required. From the time the officer returned to the emergency room with that testing kit to when Mr. Hauer was wheeled away by hospital staff, approximately 2 minutes and 45 seconds passed, under 3 minutes passed, in which the officer wanted an additional affirmative from Mr. Hauer. However, the Supreme Court has made clear in the case of the Department of Public Safety versus Pressler that after a testing subject agrees to test, no additional affirmative is needed when there is no clear.
But counsel, if I could stop you for a second, your recitation of the facts is leaving out some key aspects of what actually happened. After the officer returned back with the urine test, appellant didn't respond when he was calling his name. And so it's that lack of response that seems to indicate that the officer tried to say, hey, are you going to cooperate or not? It's not as if he just came back with the urine sample and said, okay, I know you said yes before, but I want another affirmation from you now. Appellant took action which indicated that he may not be cooperating anymore. So why wasn't the officer justified in terms of trying to make sure that he's still going to cooperate?
Your Honor, I would disagree that appellant took action to indicate he would not cooperate. Mr. Hauer sat silently, and I do agree with that he did not respond to the officer's questions during that less than 3 minute time when the officer returned. However, he had already given a clear indication that he would test, and refusal requires.
Right, but counsel, we've seen many cases where somebody initially says that they're going to cooperate. But then they take either by a word or actions or inaction, they don't cooperate. And we have found that is enough to justify a finding that the person is refusing. So why isn't that the case here?
Your Honor, that's not the case here because Mr. Hauer's actions did not rise to that level of a volitional act that is an actual unwillingness to participate in the testing process. And that's from the case of State versus Ferrier. Mr. Hauer did sit silently. However, we can contrast this with the case of Holtz versus the Commissioner of Public Safety, in which the driver sat silent essentially from the beginning of the interaction when the officer asked if he understood his rights under the implied consent, and he never responded to anything. Mr. Hauer was not silent from the get-go. He communicated in writing. I'd note additionally that when the officer returned to the emergency room with a testing kit, Mr. Hauer no longer had his pad of paper. We don't know why. The record is silent on that point, but he no longer had paper on which he could write. Perhaps he or hospital staff thought that he didn't need it any longer, that communication had occurred. But sitting silently for that short period of time, under 3 minutes, does not rise to the level of that actual unwillingness, to participate within that process. To your point of refusal by conduct, certainly refusal by conduct can establish a valid refusal. However, that conduct in case law is typically much, much greater. Again, a volitional act such as screaming.
That's one of the beauties of Zoom, right? You can kind of get an idea if somebody's going to say something. So let's assume for the sake of argument, a person gets pulled over and just says, okay, yeah, I'm willing to do whatever I can to cooperate. I prefer to give a urine sample. But then after that remains silent and doesn't respond to questions anymore, does the fact, and the officer asks the person, will you take the urine sample? Here it is. They don't respond. Are you going to take the urine sample? Can you please take the urine sample now? No response. Doesn't that seem to be frustrating the purpose? And wouldn't that allow a person to up front make it sound like they're going to cooperate, and then afterwards they don't, and then argue, well, it wasn't a refusal. I said I would, but you didn't actually do what you said you were going to do.
Right. I think that's a possibility in some situations, and I'm sure it would be fact dependent. And in this situation, perhaps in all situations, the court should consider the length of time that this went on. In this case, it was under 3 minutes, and potentially how that interaction ended. In this case, the interaction ended because hospital staff came and wheeled Mr. Hauer away, essentially said, it's time for your exam, wheeled him away. There was no question to the officer as to, are you done talking to Mr. Hauer? There was no question to Mr. Hauer, are you done? Do you need to write anything else to communicate? So in this particular case, there wasn't enough time, essentially. He didn't go those steps to get to the point of negating that prior agreement to test. Additionally, Mr. Hauer needed some help to provide a test. He was in a wheelchair, apparently could not walk. The officer said as much. He was in the public lobby. So he needed help to get to a private space, potentially help to stand up and provide a sample.
Would you agree that he understood that he needed to provide this test, that he understood the instructions and the information that the officers had provided to him about the fact that refusal to test was going to result in a charge?
I believe so. I don't think there's anything to indicate that he did not understand that.
And so I didn't see anything in the record that shows this, but perhaps there's information you can point me to. Did he indicate when he was being wheeled away that he wasn't done talking with the officer, or that he needed help to go to the bathroom, or that he otherwise needed to take any actions to comply with that testing?
The record does not show any type of indication on his part. The information largely comes from the police officer's body camera. And so one can see Mr. Howard being essentially turned and wheeled away, and so see his back retreating. We can't see if he said anything at trial. The testimony simply was from the officer saying and asking, and the officer indicated that the officer, had not made any confirmation or any further question or any further attempt to have Mr. Howard provide that sample. But to your point, there's no indication in the record that Mr. Howard made some sign as he was being wheeled away.
Did he somehow request the paper and pencil back again?
He made some sort of a gesture when, if I'm thinking the timing, getting the timing correct. He had lost the pad of paper. And when the officer returned, he made some sort of gesture that perhaps was a gesture that he wanted the paper back. The officer agreed that that could have been what he meant. The officer then took the pen out of his hand as well. Didn't ask him, are you done writing, or do you have anything else you'd like to write? But the officer removed the pen, so he didn't have either pen or paper.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no other questions on this issue, I would like to move to the second issue, which is that the trial court unduly limited Mr. Howard's questioning of potential jurors and therefore deprived Howard of the ability to make informed peremptory challenges during voir dire. And that was an abuse of discretion. During voir dire, defense counsel tried to ask a potential juror, can you think of the reason why an innocent person would not testify at trial? And that question, counsel later made clear, went to the jury's ability to apply the presumption of innocence and the right not to testify. However, the judge essentially cut off that line of questioning.
The prosecutor is an officer of the court, and it actually seems that the prosecutor was, in that role as an officer of the court in requesting that line of questioning stop, because that was an open-ended question. It wasn't a question of it wasn't a closed question of providing the yes or no answer. It was an open-ended question where the jurors could speculate and try to think of a number of different reasons. That it seems like the district court definitely did its job to make sure that the jurors didn't speculate.
Well, the court issued a broad admonition of counsel and didn't say perhaps ask another question or perhaps ask a more specific question. The court said that she would deny further questioning into the law at that point. So while defense counsel might have asked a different question or a more limited question, defense counsel went along with that judge's broad admonition not to go into the law at that point, which counsel had clarified was related to the presumption of innocence and the right not to testify, to the point that a question, a more directed question, such as, do you agree with this? How do you feel about the presumption of innocence? The court never asked those questions either. The state did not either. But oftentimes the court will ask sort of boilerplate questions to a jury panel. And in this situation, that didn't happen.
The court is the district court required to ask that question of the jurors?
The district court may not be required to ask that question. However, it would eliminate the problem that we have here where there was no other question asked. And so similar to the case of State versus Ritter, where the counsel was cut off from asking questions about how prospective jurors felt about law enforcement officials, because those questions had not been asked and were not able to be asked, those were the very questions that might have determined or that would have determined whether there was juror bias. And so the court remanded that case because counsel was not able to ask the very question that needed to be asked to determine whether there was bias. Because we don't have that indication from the district court here asking the entire panel their feelings, or if anybody disagreed that the defendant was presumed innocent, we can't take that additional step or have that additional help to say that that panel was asked a question to determine whether they had that bias. The one instruction that the judge read regarding the presumption of innocence as her introductory instructions was read before jurors were called by name and before anybody was sworn in. The instructions at the end were, of course, read as instructions, and no follow-up questions were asked of the jurors by anyone. Respondent argues that this somehow would implicate the defendant's right to remain silent if counsel had been allowed to ask this question. However, the court might consider the analogy or a similar situation of a no adverse instruction, in which case it's the defendant's call whether or not to ask it.
But counsel didn't go into the district court. Didn't the district court instruct the jury that they have a duty to presume that he was innocent and he was not required to prove his innocence?
Yes, the court did instruct the jury of that. However, there were no follow-up questions able to be asked regarding that point and from the final instructions, and there were no questions asked to the panel from the initial instructions, following the initial instructions as well. I see my time is up unless there are further questions.
We can hear from you again on rebuttal. Thank you.
Sure. Thank
and
you.
We will turn to counsel for respondent next. You have 15 minutes on the clock. Please begin when you are ready.
There we go. It wasn't allowing me to unmute. I apologize. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Wesley Van Aert. I represent the respondent, the state of Nebraska. This is an interesting case. It's one that you, I think, would expect to maybe go to trial, given just the nature of the charges and the condition of the appellant. I think the biggest difference in this case, as opposed to most criminal cases that are challenged, is a lot of times we come before challenges under, say, Fourth Amendment issues that really focus on police conduct and whether police conduct was reasonable in their actions and violated some rights. This case is quite different because we're talking about the implied consent law, and really what the focus is and what I think I reminded the jury is that this implied consent law, really the focus is on the behavior of Mr. Howard, the appellant in this case. Because the implied consent law requires all of us citizens as drivers on the roads here in Minnesota to submit to the testing under certain situations. And in this case, it was the search warrant. So again, the focus in this case is certainly on the appellant under the implied consent law. And his behavior is the focus, not so much the officer's behavior as we typically see. And so talking about that implied consent law, and what that requires. And I think Judge Reyes was questioning about this too, is the conduct of the appellant is the focus here. And was his conduct, in view of everything that happened, did that amount to a refusal? And by the way, did it via a frustration of the whole process that he is supposed to comply with and consent to by being a driver in Minnesota?
So if I may, Mr. Van Aert.
Sorry.
when we're looking at that context, so we're looking to see, is there sufficient evidence to support the conviction of refusal, right? And so you're saying, let's look at his conduct. Okay, when we're looking at that, are we using to say, you know, okay, is this enough for refusal conviction? Are we using a direct evidence or circumstantial evidence test? I note that the appellant, I think in their brief, says that we should use the circumstantial evidence test. And I did not see that addressed in your brief. And maybe I missed it. Because I think that may matter in how we look at this.
Certainly, Your Honor. And my response, I think, I can't recall the case law, but I think it's not an either or. They're not mutually exclusive. I think there can be some direct evidence to the question of fact. There can also be circumstantial evidence. In this case, I guess I would argue there was maybe more circumstantial evidence, given the fact that the way he communicates by not being able to actually speak and say, no, I'm not taking that test, for instance, that's pretty direct. And in this case, what the jury saw throughout, and if you haven't watched Deputy Lewis's video, it's a pretty good indication of how patient he was, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. And even before that, Officer Jesperson's body cam, you can see Mr. Howard communicating via the nodding of the head, yeses and nos, nodding the head. They're effectively able to communicate with him throughout, except when the question of whether he'll take the test comes up. That's the only time that he really chooses to refuse to give the nod, yes or no. And that was, Deputy Lewis indicates that when he comes back, he says, you know, we've been communicating. I know you can hear me and say yes or no and nod your head. You've been doing that, but now you're ignoring me.
So if I may, the part of applying the circumstantial evidence test that's causing me to, giving me more thought or pause here is, okay, so we look and say, are there other reasonable inferences from what you're just describing? And the one that comes to me is, look, couldn't a reasonable inference from this be he was unwilling to do the test in public? I mean, so could you help me understand your perspective on that?
Correct. And Deputy Lewis indicated, I think one of the questions I asked him at the end was, you know, he was looking for a simple yes or no to the question. And if he had Mr. Howard provided that simple yes or no, which we know he can, but chose not to, he would have taken him to a restroom to do that. He also indicated, the question was asked of him whether Mr. Howard required his assistance to get to the restroom. Deputy Lewis wasn't certain that he did. They knew it wasn't that Mr. Howard couldn't walk. They were being cautious because of a possible leg injury. Also, Officer Jesperson, when he tried to get out of the car, he stumbled, whether by injury or intoxication. But it wasn't that he couldn't walk, and Deputy Lewis wasn't sure that whether he could or couldn't. But again, the whole conduct, the point was that for many, many minutes, even before that, he went to get the urine test after the word P was written. And to be clear on that point, I'll go back. I went through and watched the video as close as I could. And because I wasn't sure if the letter P was written or the word P with an EE is written, because he tries to spell, to talk about his spelling being poor. And it looks like there was at least maybe a small E after the P, Deputy Lewis. So for the record, I think he did write P and at least one E. But Deputy Lewis was, when he thought, okay, urine test, let's do this, get the urine kit, comes back in, he pretends to be sleeping, his eyes are closed, he's ignoring him. He's again saying, if we go to the bathroom, are you going to provide a urine sample? Are you going to do this? And he just never gets that affirmative. It would have been a very simple response for him to give that. We know he can. And again, the burden necessarily, but the obligation is on the appellant to do that under the implied consent law. The officer shouldn't have to sit there and go through this, you know, situation where he's really having to, it's frustrating. It is frustrating, the process, because he's really just needing to get him to say, nod his head, yes. Okay, let's go do it. You know, but
Ms. Van Erd, I have a question along those lines. I mean, he indicated he wrote down either the letter P or the word P, but there's no question that the officer understood what was meant by that. He went to get the urine kit. He agreed, he consented at that point to provide a urine sample. But even, you mentioned the video, even in the first video, you can see he indicates, when he asked him if he was okay, and he pointed to his leg, an officer immediately called for an ambulance to transport him, saying, you know, he needs medical attention. And he was in a wheelchair, had trouble walking. So in the hospital, he's in a wheelchair. So after the officer got the urine kit, why didn't he just wheel him into a bathroom to provide a urine sample?
And good question, Your Honor. And I think from the record and what the jury heard was, he certainly would have had Mr. Howard, when he got back with the urine kit, said he would in fact provide that sample. He never shook his head yes or no. Officer or Deputy Lewis looked at the paper and said, urine, to provide a urine test. And the appellant doesn't actually respond. Deputy Lewis assumes that's what he's going to do. And then when he gets back, and again, all he needs him to do is say, are you going to do this? You know, and he just doesn't respond. And so I don't know that you can say he certainly consented. He wrote the word P on the piece of paper. But then when he was actually wanting to go give the test or collect the test.
Why isn't that enough, given the circumstances here? We have a person with a disability. The officers know he can communicate in a number of different ways, by nodding, by writing. And he did that. He wrote P on a piece of paper when asked about either a blood test or then at that point a urine test. Why isn't that enough under these circumstances?
And Your Honor, certainly the jury didn't think it was enough. They thought that his entire conduct was a refusal.
Well, right, to the totality. But let me stop you. If I can stop you there, that actually goes to Judge Jessen's, I think, excellent question. If we're relying on circumstantial evidence, we apply the two-part circumstantial evidence test, which is a higher burden in the first instance. And second, after we look at the circumstances proved, we look at all reasonable inferences, including inferences of guilt, which is what the jury found. But we also have to look at other reasonable alternative hypotheses.
Right.
So why isn't there reasonable alternative hypothesis that he did consent by saying you're writing P? He communicated his consent.
And that's a question of fact, Your Honor, if he actually consented or refused. The one instance that may be directly, even circumstantially viewed as consent was writing the word P. But before that, you see him, and the jury could still think, even though he wrote that word.
But on the circumstantial evidence test, I'm sorry, sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Banner, but under the circumstantial evidence test, the second part, we give no deference to the jury's decision.
So if you look at all the other evidence, Your Honor, my answer would be, he, when presented with the search warrant, you can see he swipes it to the floor away. That's a fact that shows that he's not consenting to it and not going to comply. The fact that when he comes back with the urine kit, the actual collection of it that's to be had, he refuses to respond. And so I think there's enough facts here that show that he was not consenting, despite writing the word P, given everything else that we saw in that video. The fact that he could respond with a yes or no, the deputy said, all I need is a yes or no, just nod your head, and he won't do it. And that is, I think, Your Honor, why it's a refusal. It's because he simply won't say whether or not he'll give the test, despite writing the word P. You look at everything else, the conduct that occurs through the whole 12, 13 minutes, it seems, from all the evidence you look at, it was more strongly that he was not consenting than that he was, and therefore refusing. Again, it's the obligation of the appellant to consent under the implied consent law. And in this case, overall, certainly, I think Deputy Lewis and everyone watching the video, it seems to be a frustration of the process, because we know he can shake his head yes and give that consent, and simply does not. And I would just note that also talk about the volitional act or actual unwillingness showing. Again, I think him refusing to simply nod yes or no is showing actual unwillingness, despite writing the letter or word P, he still showed an actual unwillingness that he was not going to provide the sample. And then I'll just, I think we're running close to time here. On the second issue, you know, I remember that trial. I remember the question and the flag kind of went up because all I could foresee was a juror, even, or anyone thinking to themselves of that open-ended question, yeah, they wouldn't testify because they're not innocent or they're guilty. And had one juror simply responded to that, you know, it certainly would have been probably a mistrial or had to really have a lot of control or I guess instruction on ignoring that. But so certainly with the Fifth Amendment, right, not to himself incriminate, the defendant had, or the attorney for the defendant had any number of questions they could have asked about the presumption of innocence. They could have asked, what does that mean to certain jurors? They could ask whether or not any juror would hold it against their client in any way for not testifying, understanding, you know, that they have that absolute right and that can't be used against them. But to speculate about why they might not just invites jurors to answer and think because they're not innocent or because they're guilty. And so I just think that that was the right thing for the court to do. I simply think if I had asked that question, I'm certainly sure it would have been objected to. So I think that was the appropriate response, Your Honor. If any other questions, otherwise I'll turn it over for rebuttal argument.
I don't see any from my fellow panelists, so thank you for your argument. And we will turn back to counsel for appellant. There will be 5 minutes on the clock, and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to briefly correct the facts as I heard Mr. Van Aert describe them. I believe that he stated that it was not clear whether Mr. Hauer could walk or not when he was in the emergency room. However, the testimony at trial from the officer was that Mr. Hauer was unable to stand or walk without assistance, and that's on the trial transcript pages 165 to 166. So he was not able to get up by himself. Regarding the assertion that the appellant, Mr. Hauer, in this case, has the obligation to essentially to test, Mr. Hauer had the obligation to agree to test. The officer does have some obligation here. The officer is not absolved of any responsibility. The officer has the obligation to facilitate the test, and that happens within a breath test. The officer runs that machine. That happens within a blood and a urine test. Perhaps medical assistance is needed. In this case, perhaps assistance is needed to get to a private place, to be able to physically be in a position to provide a urine sample. So the officer does have an obligation there. Mr. Hauer fulfilled his obligation, and then he needed some assistance to complete the test. And then I simply regarding the circumstantial evidence, I believe that the questions of Your Honors are important. There is an alternative hypothesis here. The jurors did make an inference that those under 3 minutes of silence from Mr. Hauer and non-response from Mr. Hauer, the jury inferred that that was a refusal, apparently. However, even given that evidence that there were a little bit under 3 minutes of silence when the officer returned, the alternative hypothesis exists, which is still consistent with that evidence, that he did not refuse, that he sat silently, essentially needing some help to perform that test. The additional affirmative was not required. And because there was no basis to ask for that additional test, the alternative hypothesis, which is inconsistent with guilt, is strong in this case.
Counsel, I do have a question. Did he at any point, I'm trying to recall, when the officer asked if he would take a urine test and asked him if he would nod to confirm that he would, did he ever nod at all?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, in talking okay. about those 3 minutes.
Well, I'm not talking about the 3 minutes.
Just at
I'm
all.
Looking at the entire time, because he did nod to communicate throughout, even at the beginning when he was first when the officers first approach him on the road, then jumping to the hospital, he did nod at times in response to various questions, but I don't recall him ever nodding in response to the question of, will you take this urine test?
That's so, right, Your Honor.
So why is it a reasonable alternative hypothesis to think that he actually did consent to a urine test?
Well, he did consent when he wrote pee, that he would pee, and that's how the officer interpreted it and went to get that urine test. So I believe the question is, did he revoke that consent somehow? Did he equivocate from that consent, which he wrote in writing during that under 3 minute period of time? And my answer is no, he did not, when he sat silently and did not make a volitional act to refuse to take the test at that point. If there are no further questions, in conclusion, Mr. Hauer asked this court to reverse his conviction because the state did not prove that he refused to take a urine test, and in the alternative, to reverse and remand, since the district court abused its discretion when it limited the questioning of potential jurors. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel for being here today and for your